Underworld, Disc 21.
They were 50,000 feet above the South China Sea, flying in a three-bomber formation called a cell. And there were 15 cells in the air today. And each cell carried over 300 bombs. And the resulting zone of destruction was known as a sandbox. And Chucky was bizarroed in one part of his brain by the crazy conversation he was having with old Lewis, even as he felt sad and hurt in another and nearer part by his buddy's attitude toward the girl on the nose of their aircraft.
"This song's written by a black woman from Appaloosa, Mississippi. Richard added the little touches. I guarantee, brother, this Sally we're talking about ain't no skinny blonde playing kissy face in no back seat. She's an advanced class of entertainment."
Sad and hurt, Chucky's mind began to wander to Greenland, his previous posting. Not a bad place to survive the breakup of a marriage. His human discontents were muted in the icy mists and the whole blowing other world of whiteouts and radio disruptions and unrelenting winds and total cold and objects that did not cast shadows and numerous freak readings on compasses and radar scopes and the buff that crashed on an ice sheet with live nukes aboard. Anomalies of the eye, the mind, the systems themselves. And the experience made him sense the ghost spume of some higher hippie consciousness. Or maybe Greenland was just a delicate piece of wargaming, played in a well-heated room in some defense institute, with hazelnut coffee and croissants. Lewis was conversing with the pilot in bomb speak, which must mean it was time for Chucky to pay attention. Once divorced, twice expelled from school, once fled from same, many times estranged from parents, thrice charged with petty larceny, once emergency roomed for barbiturate overdose, once experimentally wrist-slashed, many times a vomit on the pavement outside a bar. The shoplifting charges expunged from the record thanks to influential friends of Dad. "Little riches mostly for white people anyway," he muttered to Lewis.
"But Long Tall Sally's black, just so you don't forget it."
His late great dad. Not really such a bad guy in death, but so tensely parental in life, all empty command and false authority, that Chucky suspected the man's heart just wasn't in it. Now, I didn't blame his parents for everything that had gone wrong. Chucky was misery enough on his own recognizance. But he couldn't think of his father without regretting the loss of the one thing he'd wanted to maintain between them. That was the baseball his dad had given him as a trust, a gift, a peace offering, a form of desperate love, and a spiritual hand-me-down. The ball he'd more or less lost, or his wife had snatched when they split, or he'd accidentally dumped with the household trash. One of those distracted events that seemed to mark the inner nature of the age. Next to him, Lewis sat in his station with his bomb release mode and his master bomb control panel and his bombing data indicator and his urinal and his hot cup. Everything you'd want for a fulfilling life in the sky. Lewis said,
"Pilot, this is Mad Bomber. We'll release in rapid sequence. 120 seconds to drop."
Bobby Thompson and Ralph Branca meant nothing to Chucky. Vague names from his unstable childhood. The memory of the baseball itself, the night of the baseball, vague and unstable and dim. Lewis spoke through a teary-eyed yawn.
"Pilot, come right 3 degrees. Hold. Bomb doors open. Check. 60 seconds to drop."
So many missions. All those indistinguishable bombs. Chucky used to love these bomb runs, but not anymore. He used to feel a bitter and sado sort of grudge pleasure, getting even for his life, taking it out on the landscape and the indigenous population. He'd been a proud part of a bomb wing that was dropping millions of tons of ordnance off the racks and out of the bays. The bombs fluttered down on the NVA and the Arvin alike. because if the troops on both sides pretty much resemble each other, and if their acronyms contain pretty much the same letters, you have to bomb both sides to get satisfactory results. The bombs also fell on the Viet Cong, the Viet Minh, the French, the Laotians, the Cambodians, the Pathet Lao, the Khmer Rouge, the Montagnards, the Hmong, the Maoists, the Taoists, the Buddhists, the monks, the nuns, the rice farmers, the pig farmers, the student protesters and war resistors and flower people, the Chicago Seven, the Chicago Eight, the Catonsville Nine. They were all pretty much the enemy. Lewis droned on.
Steady, steady, steady. On auto now. Tone audible. 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7.
500 pounders on this run, sleek and effete. 108 of them at Lewis's drowsy touch, aimed at the Ho Chi Minh Trail. A mission based on the bullshit readings of image interpreters who spend their days and nights scrutinizing the itty-bitty blurs on nearly identical frames of recon film that unfurl endlessly across their eyeballs, more or less, Chucky thought, the way the bombs drop endlessly from the B-52s. Lewis droned on.
6, 5, 4.
And Chucky thought of the ballad of Lewis Bakey, a tale the bombardier never tired of telling, and the navigator never wanted to come to an end, because it was like a great Negro spiritual that makes your whole face tingle with reverence and awe. How Lewis comes strutting out of bombardier school and finds himself crewing on a B-52 at 26,000 feet over the Nevada test site, simulating the release of a 50-kiloton nuclear bomb. Simulating, mind you, while an actual device of this exact magnitude is meanwhile being detonated from the shot tower directly beneath the aircraft. The idea being, let's see how the aircraft and crew react, metal-wise and body-wise, to the flash, the blast, the shock, the spectacle, and so on. And if they come through it more or less intact, maybe we'll let them drop their own bomb someday. Whole planes blacked out. Windows shielded by curtain pads covered with Reynolds wrap. Crew holding pillows over eyes, little nylon pillows that smell to Lewis intriguingly like a woman's underthings. A volunteer medic sits in a spare seat with 5 inches of string hanging out of his mouth and a tea bag tag at the end of it. He has swallowed the rest of the string, which holds an X-ray plate coated with aluminum jelly, dangling somewhere below the esophagus to measure the radiation passing through his body. Lewis does his phony countdown and waits for the flash. A strong and immortal young man on a noble mission.
3, 2, 1.
Then the world lights up. A glow enters the body that's like the touch of God. And Lewis can see the bones in his hands through his closed eyes, through the thick pillow he's got jammed in his face.
I move my head. This whole skeleton's dancing in the flash. The navigator, the instructor navigator, the sad-ass gunner, we are dead men flying. I thought, Lord God, Jesus. I swear to Jesus, I thought this was heaven. Sweat is rolling down my face, and there's smoke coming off the circuit breakers, and the detonation's blowing us thousands of feet up, against our best intentions. I thought I was flying right through Judgment Day, with some woman's nylon breasts plumped up in my face. And when the shock wave hit, we got pummeled up another 2,000 feet, this big tonnage aircraft acting like a leaf on a blowy night. And I kept seeing the flying dead through closed eyes, skeleton men with knee bone connected to the thigh bone. I hear the word of the Lord. And I thought because being a black man, I would be harder to see through. But I saw right through my skin to my bones. This flash too bright to make racial niceties. All the same in God's eyes, so let that be a lesson. And the medic, with the string hanging out of his mouth and his hand on the tea bag tag so he won't swallow it. And I can see the X-ray plate through skin, bones, ribs, and whatnot. And it's glowing like a sunrise on the desert.
When it is safe to withdraw the pillow and open his eyes, Lewis opens his eyes and puts down the pillow and makes his way to the cockpit and helps the co-pilot remove the thermal curtains. And there it is, alive and white above them, the mushroom cloud. And it is boiling and talking and crackling like some almighty piss-all vision.
My eyes went big and stayed that way and ain't ever really closed. Because I seen what I seen. That thing's so big and wide and high above us. And it was popping and heaving like nothing on this earth. And we flew right past the stem, and it's rushing and whooshing and talking. It's pushing the cloud right up into the stratosphere.
Thigh bone connected to the hip bone.
In a few years, I lost my handwriting skills. Can't write my name without wobbles and skips. I pee in slow motion now, and my left eye sees things that belong to my right.
And that was the ballad of Lewis Bakey, told to 1,000 airmen on wind-howling bases through the short days and long years of constant alert in the dark and stoic heart of Cold War winters.
"Bombs away," said Lewis blandly.
But the mean and cutting fun had gone out of it for Chucky. He didn't want to kill any more V.C., and he was developing a curious concern for the local landscape. Tired of killing the forest, the trees of the forest, the birds that inhabit the trees, the insects that live their whole karmic lives nestled in the wing feathers of the birds. The aircraft racked into a tight turn.
"Lewisman, don't you ever wake up in the middle of the night? Don't start in with me. Thinking there's got to be a more productive way to spend your time? That's what they're thinking down there. Than dropping bombs on people who never said a cross word to you. Living in tunnels. I tell you what they're thinking. They're living in tunnels, they dig in the ground, and we're in a big, ugly, fat fuck pounding the shit out of them. And they're thinking there's got to be a more productive way."
A number of times lately on these routine missions, Chucky has had ejection fantasies. Check the leg guards and ankle restraints, and then pull the trigger ring, and boom. He'd be fired down and out and into the smoky sky. To come floating over Golden Gate Park, in the playful movie version, where a miniskirted blonde named Sally raises her head from a copy of Franz Fanon, maybe, or Herbert Marcuse. Two authors Chucky has had a tough time finding in the PX at the base, to see a polka-dot parachute dropping toward the treetops. No, he'd never been a fan, but the baseball had been sweet to have around. Yes, sweet. Beaten, seamed, virile and old. A piece of personal history that meant far more to him than the mobbed chronicles of the game itself. The aircraft headed back to Guam, which rhymes with bomb. But he was thinking of Greenland now, the shadowless white maw, the tricks of light, vistas without horizons at the end of them. A place that never became more than a rumor, even to those who were based there, most of all to those, the kind of unverified information that resembled his life. Down out of the sky, finally. When they landed, he heard the hot screech of the wheels and felt the drag chute pop and hold. He knew the follow-me truck was out there on the taxiway, but he couldn't see it, of course, still stuck for a few minutes longer in the dim-lit hole surrounded by his acronyms. Lewis said,
"I want pussy, Chuck, man, and I want it now. But she's got to respect me and what I do."
"And what you stand for?"
"What I stand for. Very good, son. I see I'm getting through to you."
The truck said, "Follow me," and the ground crew was already moving toward the aircraft, dragging hoses, pipes, lines of test gear. The men prepared to go through a checklist the size of 11 lengthy novels on the subject of war and peace.
"Because if she don't respect me," Lewis said, "I feel empty when it's over."
"I know the feeling."
"The feeling never changes."
"First we fuck them."
"Then we bomb them," Lewis said.
and it wouldn't be long at all before the massive aircraft lumbered down the runway again, fatted with ordnance, every rivet straining at the takeoff, up, out, over, a mortal power in the sky. Chapter 7. November 9th, 1965. It was a place you might wander into if you didn't know the neighborhood. A graveyard bar under a bridge approach. And you might mistake the place at a glance for one of those 8th Avenue bars that never seem to close. The Red Rose, or the White Rose, or the Blarney Stone, where the pipe fitters and garment workers go. Or the Railbirds, back from the track. Or the Insomniacs, back from nowhere. A sandwich and a beer, or a shot and a beer. But this was another category altogether. A place practically outside time, called Frankie's Tropical Bar on the Lower East Side. And who do I see when I walk in the door but Jeremiah Sullivan, speaking of graveyards, because he didn't look too good.
Am I seeing right?
I said, "Hello, Jerry."
"Nick Shea. Where the hell did you come from?"
I said, "Hello, Jerry. Where are we?"
"I know where I am. Where the hell are you? I hear things every so often. California, Arizona. I saw your mother 3-4 years ago. It's been, what, 15 years?
I said, "I'm in town for a week doing a research project for some outfit in the Midwest. What about you?"
"Don't be so calm. 15 almost fucking years. What are you drinking?"
"What are you drinking?"
"Don't ask,"
he said. "That's what I'll have." He looked around for the bartender, but the guy was gone. A man with a bandaged head sat at the far end of the bar trying to bounce a coin into a shot glass. And there were two women on stools not far from where Jerry was standing. A couple of local biddies, you might assume, only they weren't cozy or talky or interested in other people's talk. Just ancient and wasted regulars of the art. We traded the pure facts of whereabouts and job, and then Jerry supplied elaborate reports on people we'd grown up with. News he'd probably been storing for an occasion such as this. His suit pants sagging under his paunch, and his tie knotted halfway down his shirt front.
"You married, Nick?"
"No."
"You seeing someone special?"
"No. I met a woman recently in Chicago, but no's the answer. I'm not the marrying type. I don't see myself married. I don't feel marriage bound. Don't even think about it."
"In your wildest dreams?" "Me, I'm married. 2 kids. I'd show you pictures, but you don't want to see pictures."
The bartender showed up, and I got a stinger that overflowed the glass. It was late afternoon in fading light, and there was a palm tree mural, unfinished, behind the bar, and a live sombrero dangling from a beam. Jerry said this used to be a jazz club that failed almost immediately, and after they dropped the music, and after the clientele changed, he found he kept coming back. He needed an hour between the office and the family to be alone, he said, and think. He was right. I didn't want to see pictures.
"I'm 30, he said. "When my father was 35, he looked like an old man."
"Only to you. You were in first grade. They all looked like old men."
"Nah, he was old. He was worn down. It's good to see you, Nick. I think about you. I go back there. The place was so crowded once. Now it's empty."
We'd gone to grammar school together, with the nuns. And then Jerry had gone to a Catholic high school, and I switched to public, and we saw each other only rarely, in a movie lobby, maybe, buying a Coke. He's with his friends, I'm with mine. And there was a curious sense of separation, not unfriendly, but deep. And it was the school difference, partly, the veering of habits and practices, but also something irreconcilable, the style, the friends, the future.
"You've been away a hell of a long time. A hell of a long time. Maybe you want to think about coming back," he said.
"Live here? Forget it. No, I like it out there."
"Out there? What's out there?"
everything you've never heard of.
If I never heard of it, how terrific can it be?
He said. We used to call him Jumpy Jerry because he twitched and squinted, and still did, I noticed, wearing glasses now and a school ring. I didn't tell him about the Jesuits. Too interesting. He'd keep me here for hours. I told him about the project I was working on, to alter traditional methods of school instruction, and how I'd been visiting schools in ghettos and marginal parts of town here and in Philadelphia as a freelance associate in a behavioral research firm in Evanston, Illinois.
And you teach?
I've taught. And I'll go back to it, probably, I said, sooner or later. Secondary schools. Civics and English. But I want to teach Latin. This was also too interesting. He should have been royally amused, but it was too interesting for that. Jerry had seemed for a time to be priestward bound. That was the word on him. Or the Irish Christian Brothers, maybe. And it put a look of total dislocation on his face, thinking of the Nicky he used to know and the one he'd hear about later doing Latin in a classroom.
You go see your mother?
Went up there yesterday, I said.
She's still in 611?
Still there.
I like to go back, he said. I go eat on Arthur Avenue. I walk all over. I take my kids to the zoo.
See it now. It's disappearing.
It used to be so crowded. Or is that just in my mind? The summer nights? Fantastic. It's great to see you, Nick. I'm having one more. Have one more.
I wanted to finish the first one and leave. Or not finish it and leave. A chance meeting like this, if you run it 5 minutes longer than it's worth, you ruin the night and the following day. He kept adjusting his glasses. A man alone at a table was moaning a bummed-out monologue that involved being followed wherever he went, and they were recording his private thoughts, and they were sending the seeing eye blind to spy on him with their dogs and their pencils and their cups, and they were doing this on buses and subways both.
Jerry, you ought to go home and play with your kids. When you're 50 or 60, you can come here and think about the past.
But he didn't want to go home. He wanted to recite the destinies of 100 linked souls, the street swarm that roared in his head. The dead, the married, the moved to Jersey, the kid with 5 sisters who became a safecracker, the handball ace who's a chiropractor, the stuck-up blonde in the 5th grade who married a Puerto Rican prize fighter.
We gotta go up there, Nick. Serious. Take the subway. We'll be there in 45 minutes. We can get dinner at Mario's. I'll make some calls. Get some of the guys. They'll love it. They'll meet us. Serious, man. Come on. Drink. We'll go.
His voice carried an urgent logic. He was defensive and a little angry, and about halfway drunk, gripped by the plan, and a little angry in advance, wary of the thought that I might not see the beauty and inevitability of a trip to the Bronx, that I might be unswayed by the power of old time's sake, and he was already sensing the edges of a bitter affront.
Come on, serious, we'll take the subway. We'll go see LaFaro, some of the old faces. They'd love to see you, Nick.
I didn't want to put him off, to seem outside this or above it. Jerry knew I'd been in correction, and then more or less lost to news and rumor, and now here I was turned out in a tweed jacket and doing a job I liked and looking okay. Stopped smoking, didn't overdo the drinking, knew a woman with a sexy cello voice, and was probably regularly banging her. And then look at him. Nice Catholic boy gone baggy and stale. Hates going home, a wife in Jackson Heights and 2 small kids, and he's lighting 1 cigarette with the butt of another, and drinks so much he blacks out, and sells commercial time for a radio station at the end of the dial, and all because he's never killed a man.
This is a thing we have to do, Jerry said. We'll grab a cab, on me.
A man named Jorge started a conversation with the bartender. Jorge wore a headband and looked sexually deranged. I didn't think of these people as regulars, exactly. They were denizens. That was the word, somehow, from the late Latin, deep within. And that's what they were like, trapped souls trying to emerge. And I began to understand that Jerry came here so he could put aside self-pity and the gnaws of practical worry, and be with people who would talk to him in a kind of delusional plainsong. A run-on voice without ordinary sense or strict meter, but coming from deeper inside than he could bear to hear in his own locution. The lights dimmed and flickered. Jerry was talking to me, and there was a woman with Jorge who was saying something to the bartender about the optimum temperature of beer, and that's when the lights dimmed and flickered and then went out. Jerry was saying, "Spur of the moment, I'll make some calls. I'll get some guys. I'll get, what's his name? Allie. This is a thing, my friend, where you don't have the right to refuse." Then the lights went out. The man at the far end of the bar stopped trying to bounce quarters into his shot glass. Someone said, "Is that the lights?" We sipped our stingers, Jerry and I. The bartender said, "You know what?" Someone started talking in the men's room, loud enough for us to hear. The bartender said, "Looks like from here the whole block's out." The first voice said, "Is that the lights?" "They must be working on something that caused the short," the bartender said, "and me without candles." The voice from the toilet grew louder and agitated. One of the old women said something to the other, the first words out of either of them. Jerry and I sipped our stingers. "But you know what?" the bartender said. Jorge was speaking Spanish now. The bartender came up with a flashlight from the bottom of the bar, and he wedged it between two bottles on the shelf beneath the mural. The woman with Jorge was also speaking Spanish, but badly, talking to the man in the toilet. The bartender went over to the doorway. "I thought Allie was killed in Korea."
"That was Vigiano, Korea."
"Stepped on a mine," I thought.
"That was Mike. Stepped on a mine. Vigiano."
The two old women were silent again, adjusted to the dark, sitting there drinking.
"So all these years, you're telling me?"
"You've been carrying around the wrong war casualty."
"Or the right war, but the wrong guy."
"Let's go outside," he said. "I want to see what's happening."
"I don't have to feel sorry for Allie anymore."
"I think the whole block's out. Allie's selling fish at his father's stall in the market. We'll find him. I'll call him."
We took our drinks out to the sidewalk. The block was out, and the area was out. It was after 5, dark now, and the traffic lights were also out. And we could hear the pulse of car horns at the entrance to the bridge above us and to the west. People were coming out of shops and apartments, the locksmith and grocery and check-cashing place, and they stood around and talked. We could look down a tenement street to the east and see the river, a narrow strip of shimmer that formed a kind of softness, a visual whisper behind the dark bulk contours in the foreground.
"Is Brooklyn out? I think Brooklyn's out."
"Brooklyn's definitely out."
People talked to each other and looked up periodically. They looked toward the midtown sky, or tried to look toward the tip of the island, blocked off, of course, by clustered buildings, but always up, sky-watching. And they pointed and talked. I went back inside and put my drink on the bar. I left some money near the glass. Someone was still in the toilet, agitated in Spanish, saying something about his mother, or someone's mother. And I figured he couldn't find the toilet paper, or he couldn't find the bolt on the door, and it was a matter the Denisons would have to deal with. Then I stood in the doorway and watched Jerry talking to the bartender and 3 or 4 others 20 yards up the street, and they were lighted intermittently by passing cars, and they were animated, they were roused by the vastness of the circumstance, by the forces involved, and they were talking and pointing. I went down the street in the other direction. After half a block, I crossed to the opposite side and walked through an archway, under the bridge, and into an area filled with household garbage and smashed cars and mounds of rubble dumped by construction crews, and at the north end of the passage I could see the silhouetted towers of Midtown, exact and flat against the streaked sky, and I heard the sound of car horns building, the dinosaur death of stalled traffic at rush hour, calling and answering everywhere. And I made my way out the other end, where the headlights of barely moving cars stopped dead, where rivers of barium light marked my progress through the streets. October 29th, 1962. He was back in New York, the womb of consciousness, a midnight show at Carnegie Hall, nearly 3,000 people. And he stood on the enormous stage looking out across the orchestra and up past two tiers of boxes to the gallery levels, where they stood in the aisles and crowded the exits. Lenny Bruce in concert.
New York, New York, we say it twice. Once to entice them to leave Kansas, and once more over their grave.
They heaved in their seats.
New York, New York! Like a priest doing his Latin gig. Mumbo jumbo, mumbo jumbo. He says it twice, because he's talking about shit, piss, and corruption, and he wants to be sure you understand.
His people were here. The A&R guys from the Brill Building. The fellow comics who worked toilets all over Jersey. The actors and would-be actors and actor-waiters and cab drivers with equity cards. The balding men from the Upper West Side were here, with shaggy sidelocks and intimations of suffering. And the women were with them, frizzy, lippy, opinionated, with full bodies and big, rich, real faces and a brassy way of laughing. Lenny wore a white slimline suit, well-pressed, and a puce pimp shirt with a roll collar. Like a man trying to remind himself he is indestructible. It was midnight in a driving rain, but they were all here. Musicians and folkies, writers for the High Dome journals, a selection of people with wasted chalk faces and needle lesions under their clothes, and there were a fair number of disembodied others just finished smoking some DMT, the quick-acting chemical superhigh devised by NASA to get us to the moon and back whether we want to go or not. He looked up and down and around.
What a crazy, nerve-wracked, morbid week. We're all drained. We were minutes from being fireballed. But now...
He looked past the slender columns into the depths of the third tier, and then up at the faces hanging over the balustrade at the top of the house, young people glowing slightly in the overspill from spotlights placed high on the side walls.
We're not gonna die!
He did a minstrel dance step, mouth wide, hand high, fingers spread, and stood there laughing a while.
Yes, they saved us. All the Ivy League men in those striped suits and ribbed black socks that go all the way to the knee, so when they cross their legs on TV we don't see a patch of spooky white flesh between the sock and the pants cuff. It's so vulnerable, Dig, that strip of pale skin. The legs of powerful men tend to be hairless, which makes them feel secretly weak and effeminate. So they make sure they're wearing high enough socks. Garters are a tricky business for exactly this reason. Now, yes, they saved us. They did it. Russians agreed to remove missiles and end construction of missile bases in Cuba. Khrushchev is retching in his latkes. He's taking hot baths to relax. Like a plastic pouch of corn coming to a boil.
Lenny's teenage fanatics were here, kids from Brooklyn and Queens who did his bits word for word, memorizing off his albums, but more religiously from the rare tapes slyly recorded by traffickers in contraband goods, and Bronx boys who lope along the Grand Concourse to catch every foreign flick at the Ascot, hoping for a glimpse of titty. Lenny was their diamond cutter, their cool, doomed master of uncommon truth.
They saved us in their horn-rim glasses and common-sense haircuts. They got their training for the missile crisis at 1,000 dinner parties. Where it's at, man, this is the summit of Western civilization. Not the art and the schlocky museums or the books in the libraries where bums off the street infest the men's rooms. Forget all that. Forget the playing fields of Eton. It's the seating plan at dinner. That's where we won. Because they toughed it out. Because they were tested in the cruelest setting of all.
where tremendous forces come into play and crucial events unfold. Dinner parties. Dig it in the Northeast Corridor. Your mother used to say, "Mick, sweetheart." There was anxiety, a little hidden terror in her voice, because she knew, mix or die. And that's why we won, because these men were named and raised for this moment. Yes, tested at 1,000 formative dinners. It started in adolescence, seated next to adults, total strangers, and forced to make conversation. What a sadistic thing to tell a kid. Make conversation. Some couldn't do it. Some broke down and were sent to forestry school. They smoked roots and leaves and grew facial hair. They developed involved relationships with animals. But others, the others masturbated to marching songs and married their second cousins and grew strong and dominant. You know they're powerful men when their wives play bridge with the curtains drawn. The sunlight gives them migraines. They twist their handkerchiefs when they talk. Remember how your Aunt Tova would sit twisting her hanky? "Stand up straight," she'd say. "Talk to people," she'd say. "Try for me, sweetheart." Through the long night, too long, 3 solid hours nonstop, too long because it has to be too long. They've just survived a crisis and need to be intemperate, and too long because Lenny just can't stop. He looks up from under the proscenium arch and sees the ornamented ceiling and the gilded rows of boxes, and he knows this is the temple of Casals and Heifetz and Toscanini, and it gives him a mainline jolt. And too long because he's been running on scared fumes all week, and he feels revived, alive, ready to wail the night away. The disc jockeys were here, guys who did late-night jazz and voices of smoky innuendo. Celebrities were spaced through the orchestra, called the Parquet with a capital P. Mixed-race couples were here, displaying a honed nonchalance. People bored with ordinary comedy, people who wanted to be challenged and attacked, who wanted to hear their well-meaning sentiments exposed as so much liberal dinner prattle. Lenny screwed the mic off the stand and blessed them all. "Let me tell you the untold story of the week. The president called the Pope." A stir of anticipation. But it puts him off. He's not in the mood for popes tonight. "Yeah, they were in secret communication all week. Never mind all that separation of church and state crap. They stick together, these crossbacks." Popes are automatically funny. They don't need Lenny to dignify their shtick. "The Pope's got submarines, you know. Just say the word, Johnny, I send. We annihilate them, some bitches." "Your Holiness, I'm astonished, man. You have your own fleet of subs?" Lenny lost interest. He swerved into sermons and admonitions, streams of rumination on patriotism, communism, the income tax, and women who insert cigarettes in their pussies and blow perfect smoke rings. And when he said something funny or produced an occasional zing of insight and they applauded, he said, "No, don't, please. Let me fly on my own. I've always known. I've known since childhood. I'm as corrupt as they are. I grew up here. The police are crooked and so am I. The politicians lie and I lie worse. I want to kill myself on television so people can go to sleep with the face of a dead sinner on the rim of their eyeballs." They saw the lounge lizard with bedroom eyes. They saw and heard the frisky kid with the adenoidal voice, the boy who wants to make his mother laugh. They heard the frantic talker who chases after his own discontinuous ideas. They saw the zonked layabout, all lassitude and spent attention span. They heard the crusader for dirty words, the social philosopher, the self-styled lawyer, the self-critical Jew, the Christian moralizer, and the commentator on race. "I flew in from Miami last night and took a taxi direct to the Apollo Theater, where I met up with some friends for the late show because I love that scene. And we came out after the show, and I've got a suitcase and a garment bag, and it's late and it's cold. And we can't find a cab because cabs don't go to Harlem. And so we start wandering, dig? And we come across an old man in a corner doing a rap for 3 people. He's about 100 years old. And he's preaching to 3 sorry souls, and it's like Hyde Park Corner, only in blackface. Lenny did a fair approximation of a street preacher's voice, which was surprising, which was very unhip, in fact, because even if he'd started in the business as a mimic, doing Cagney and Bogart with German accents, and even if he updated frequently, doing contemporary types of every persuasion, it was not a white comic's option these days to do a black man's voice, was it? The old man holds a dollar bill by its edges. It's older than he is. He peers over the top and says, "Legal tender." He says, "Which is a name, I have to admit, I would not think to call it myself." He says, "We all seen the machines print the money and the newsreels nonstop like bottles of pop getting capped, only lightning fast. And they print, they print, they print. But where's it all go is my question. I ain't seen any. You seen any?" Lenny did the voice, standing slightly hunched beneath the vast draped curtain in his white Italianate suit and campy black boots, the ones with little fruity loops in back.
He says,
"Nobody knows the day or the hour."
He's standing there in a dark, shrunken suit with bicycle clips around the ankles. Understand me when I say I wanted to give him everything I own. Not out of pity or charity or some vintage Christian shit. Out of appreciation. Out of gratitude for the sight and sound of him at that hour and in that place. Because this is New York, New York, and we say it twice because it's half us and half them, all ours, dig it, in bicycle clips. The man's an actor, and this is his gig that he's perfected over decades. And I stand there listening, and in some funny way I hear myself, all right? Or I see myself. I imagine myself at the age of 10 or 12 listening to a voice like this old man's. It's his voice and his week, the day and the hour. And he holds the dollar bill. When the hour comes, he says, "The world be separated into those that can read the message and those that can't." A long pause. A hush in the hall. Lenny seemed half lost in reverie, in conjure. And maybe people began to feel uncomfortable because he could not seem to stop doing the voice. It was as if the voice had been crossed with his own. It was as if cross voices were unavoidable, whether you knew it or not, whether you liked it or not. And maybe this old black man spoke in Lenny's voice at times, alone, unknowing, in his room, on some level, hearing the bandy scales in his head, the push and shove of Lenny's own fluted music. And Lenny did the old man's, spoke in the old man's, unavoidably.
Then he looked at us, over on the side where we're standing. We're a black guy, a white guy, and two white women. Except one of the women has been on the street all this time looking for a cab. He looked at us briefly, took brief notice, seemed to know us in this brief look. Then he turned back to the original audience, these three lost people of the streets, these wastelings of the lost world, the lost country that exists right here in America, and he resumed his rap, and they stood there listening.
Lenny did the voice a little longer. And when he finished, he had to pause again to return to the stage, the hall, and the audience.
I wanted to give him my garment bag full of suits, my suitcase full of drugs, my house in the Hollywood Hills. We listened only 8-9 minutes, less. A cab pulled up and we left, and I won't go back because I don't know why, I just won't. Bugged out by the whole scene. His life, his rap. I gotta tell Polish lightbulb jokes.
A laugh, finally.
I gotta stand here doing Chinese waiter jokes.
He did a Chinese waiter joke. Got a big laugh. He went through a medley of movie bits, and they loved it. He did routines he used to do when he wore a polo coat, suede shoes, and a muff diver's tickly mustache. They laughed. He moped. He did the old bits with suitable stinging irony, but this only made them funnier and got him more depressed. They laughed. He bled. Lenny felt awful. He was supposed to be happy and revitalized, but he wasn't. They'd all survived a hellish week, and he'd gone dragging through 4 club dates coast to coast in a state of graduated disarray, and now it was over, and he was safe, and he was appearing in concert, And he should have been standing here chanting, "We're not gonna die, we're not gonna die, we're not gonna die," leading them in a chant, a mantra that was joyful and mock joyful at the same time, because this is New York, New York, and we want it both ways. When he thought they were going to die, he'd chanted the die line repeatedly. But that was over now. He'd forgotten all that. There were other, deeper, vaguer matters. Everything. Nothing. Him. "I came here tonight to be loved like no one was ever loved. Love me like you've never loved anyone before. Come rain or come shine." There was an unguarded plea in Lenny's eyes. "Parent, child, or lover, I want to be washed in rivers of love." Return to seat, return to seat, return to seat. The old material was making him feel bad, and the laughs were worse than the jokes. The laughs dashed and disheartened him. He switched, more or less in mid-sentence, to a bit he'd been thinking about before all this missile shit, sitting on a can in L.A., because that's where his best ideas tended to drift into range. In fact, he'd made a casual reference to the subject earlier in the evening. Got a response that seemed to indicate they were interested and unnerved. He decided to develop the bit on the spot. "Okay, an illiterate, sad-eyed virgin lives in a whorehouse in the slum district of San Juan. She has a special talent that has nothing to do with sex, per se. It's a kind of parlor trick, okay? Men pay half a week's wages to crowd into a bare room in the basement, where the girl, smooth-skinned and innocent, lifts her dress, drops her panties, takes a lit cigarette from the madam, and inserts it, filter-first, in her snatch. The men go wide-eyed. It's a king-size Kent with a micronite filter. Then she contracts her labial muscles, or whatever, and sort of inhales vaginally, and removes the cigarette and proceeds to blow a series of gorgeous smoke rings. A gasp from the men. Perfect round rings wafting up from her fleecy bush, still somewhat fine and sparse." Lenny's audience didn't exactly gasp, as the men in the whorehouse had, but there was a certain disquiet in the hall, underscored by a smatter of nervous laughter. "Some people interpret the girl's gift in a religious manner. They think it's an omen, a sign from heaven that the world is about to end. God has selected a poor, illiterate, undernourished orphan girl to convey a profound message to the world. Because isn't it possible that all these O's coming out of her womb refer to the Greek letter that means the end? Others say, journalists, scientists, priests, these men have come to the bordello to witness the event, and they say the rings she is blowing are not representations of the Greek letter Omega. They're just ordinary alphabet soup O's, however beautifully formed. These people say that when the girl is able to blow actual Greek Omegas with the horseshoe effect, dig, the little dipsy-doo at each end of the opening, then they'll start believing in miracles." This is Lenny Bruce material. This is what they came for, isn't it? Who else does this material? If it's disgusting, so much the better. If it's insulting to you as an individual, get up and leave and take your crossword puzzle husband with you. So, a rich American widower shows up one night, slumming with friends, and the girl stares proudly, con dignidad, right into his face. Then she inserts the tip of the filter in her snatch and blows a ring inside another ring, and then a third tiny ring inside that. The millionaire is shocked at the tawdry spectacle, but also secretly intrigued, and he finds himself going back there night after night alone. And it isn't long before he falls in love with the girl. Yes, her limpid eyes and dimpled knees and her sweet and fleecy pubes. He resolves to save her from this squalid life and more or less buys her from the madam for an enormous sum of money and takes her to his hilltop mansion overlooking the Hudson River, where he brings in teams of doctors, tutors, psychologists, and nutritionists, and where he watches the girl develop intellectually and grow into a healthy young woman who speaks four languages and shows a talent for the oboe. Lenny paused here, pointing out that the end, the punchline, would have to involve some reversion to type, something the girl does that demonstrates the power of a single old and shocking habit over any number of civilizing influences. Then he said,
"No, yes, wait. We've got it backwards. It's not the girl who reverts, it's the man. Dig it. He's the kind of cat who questions everything he does, begins to ask himself, was she a twisted child or an artist? Was she jailbait or saint? In other words, did he make a terrible mistake bringing her here and educating her and banning cigarettes from her life? He begins to recall those delirious nights in San Juan."
Lenny gave the name of the city an authentic guttural rumble.
"Yes, those nights in the basement of the stinking bordello where she performed. Admit it, fool. You've destroyed a strange, crude, beautiful, and eerie perversion and replaced it with a boring oboe, which she plays incessantly, by the way, and which is anyway just a displaced version of the king-sized Kent, normalized and concertized."
Lenny stood sideways, mic in hand, stroking his jaw.
"He longs to see smoke rings coming out of her puss, her nook. First the cigarette between her spindly legs, then the rising rings. When he bought her from the madam, she was on the verge of intertwining the rings, which is either a symbol of the Blessed Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, or it's the Ballantine beer logo, purity, body, and flavor. Either way, imagine the rush he would have gotten."
He looked into the wings, thinking.
"They marry, in a smoke-free ceremony on the rolling lawn. On their wedding night, still a virgin, she stands in a negligee by the window, facing west. He enters, in pajamas and smoking jacket, holding a cigarette in a cigarette holder, an unlit king-size Kent."
But he wasn't sure how to end it.
"He takes the cigarette out of the holder and extends it in her direction, glancing at the shadowy mound under her negligee. She steps back, horrified. She says, 'You must be mad.' She says it in four languages. She says almost everything in four languages, a habit that's beginning to piss him off."
Then Lenny got a better idea, deeper, more challenging.
"Wait, listen, though. The millionaire is a myth, isn't he? We stuck him in the story because we needed a rich, weak, do-gooder, what, a respectable, self-deluding jerk who shows his corruption in the end. We made him up. Let's tell the truth this time."
He sensed a disappointment out there. They wanted the wedding night, the negligee, the boudoir, the casually cruel ending, like the bit he used to do about the boy raised by wolves, found in the wild, fed, developed, educated, who graduates with honors from MIT and is killed a week later chasing a car down the street.
"Let's tell the truth," he said. "Nobody saved the girl from a life of perversion. She fled the whorehouse on her own initiative. She saved all the meager cash handouts the customers had been giving her, and she took a plane to New York, the Roach Coach, in order to find her mother, who wasn't dead at all. Another easy myth."
Shit. He was ruining their fun. He could feel the cooling all the way up to the cheap seats, where his teenage fans craved a final grossness draped over the rails, some epic sicko finish.
"She never worked in a whorehouse at all," Lenny said. "She never dropped her drawers or blew smoke rings from her pussy. Fact of the matter, she never lived in San Juan, baby."
He loved to say San Juan. And yes, he was dissembling the whole structure. He felt their puzzlement and couldn't blame them.
"Let's make her human. She's real, like us. You take the subway to the South Bronx, where she lives with her junkie mother who can't kick. She's just barely old enough so that men are beginning to notice. Her mother comes and goes, disappears, comes back. Phone company shuts off the phone. Landlord's been coming around, or putting dispossessors under the door because you never actually see him. He's a corporation called XYZ Realty with a post office box in Greenland. The girl's hiding in the empty lots down the maze of back alleys because her mother's gone again and she thinks the landlord will have her arrested. Let's make her human. Let's give her a name."
But he didn't give her a name. He couldn't think of a name, not a real name. He went back to old jokes instead. He told a mother-in-law joke, and they laughed because, in fact, it was funny. He told a Jewish mother joke, even better, and they loved it. They laughed. And he worked his way back to form, doing race, sex, religion. And it was funny and offensive, Lenny. And the night ended finally in booming waves of laughter and applause, in spirited shouts from the kids in the top tiers. And he stood on the great stage in his stupid white suit, small and remorseful. And then he turned and walked toward the wings. November 9th, 1965. Hours later, I was still walking. I walked right past my hotel and kept on going, a nondescript building near Times Square, where they'd give me a candle and show me the door that led to the stairwell. But I wanted to keep on walking, and where I'd only have to climb 5 flights, but I wanted to walk into the night and see this thing. I saw taxis with off-duty signs lit up, but people took them anyway, just opened the doors and got in, because the cabs were captive to the traffic and couldn't shy off and speed away. And I raised the collar of my jacket and walked east a while, and went past a huge crowd near the main library, and finally realized it was a bus stop, 600 or 700 people at a bus stop, easily that many, massed and more or less orderly, packed along the sidewalk and up on the library steps, and the wind whipping down Fifth, and they were waiting for a bus. I didn't have a coat. My coat was in Evanston, Illinois. I hunched in my jacket and saw people walking across the Queensboro Bridge, and they were taking over the bridge. They were walking 8 or 9 abreast, maybe 50 deep, followed by a sequence of crawling cars. Then another band of pedestrians, and they were walking home to Queens. That's when I got the idea and felt the twinge of regret. I stopped for dinner in a candlelit restaurant in the 70s, where they seated me with 3 others because it was shared tables tonight. There was only 1 subject, of course, at least for a while, and we wondered how widespread the blackout might be and whether it was sabotage. And someone said, a book editor with a bow tie, that this was the title of an early Hitchcock film with Sylvia Sidney. And he named the rest of the cast compulsively, a film that starts with the lights going out. We skipped dessert and coffee for the sake of those waiting online, and I had a drink in a bar nearby and thought Jerry was right, Jerry Sullivan. This was the twinge, the pinch of guilt. We ought to be going to the Bronx tonight, Jerry and I. Not trying to commandeer a taxi, but walking all the way. Something crazy and emotional. A trek through a city gone dark and cold. But then I thought, stupid, no, forget it. We'd lose interest on the way, or get in a fight with looters and muggers, or just get tired, or Jerry would, and what happens after that? A man directed traffic with a rolled-up magazine, a man of some girth, but quick on his feet, dipping and gliding, addressing the major mess at 86th Street. A man who shrugged off beeping horns and did 100 semaphores, extravagant of gesture, in a topcoat with a velvet collar, his glossy baton flashing, and people pausing to watch, and there was a great and fervent feeling that attended his performance, which was conscientious and deft, however befrilled by theater, and it spread among the people in the street. But it would have been tremendous somehow, too, a beautiful thing, I thought, walking up Manhattan and into the Bronx as a gesture, a remembrance, and all the way to the old neighborhood, tonight of all nights, with the world coming down. But what would we do when we got there at 2 in the morning? People walked along listening to transistor radios because there were stations with auxiliary power, and there were men wrapped in headscarves who sold flashlights and candles. And there were candles in thousands of apartment windows, and people on line for candles outside the 5 and 10, and long lines at phone booths on every second corner. The power grid gone. What did it mean? The whole linked system down. Or not linked sufficiently, perhaps. Sylvia Sidney in the dark. From certain vantages, the city was all haunted silhouette, secret and recessed, its neon ego shut down. There was a sky tonight. The towers across the park were planed down to a kind of night velvet that was etched and deathly, and lacking the static that makes the high nights throb. I heard the sound of drums, drum beats, not staccato shots, but hand drums, maybe, dull and soft skin coming out of the park. I was a stranger here. I knew Manhattan only at street level, fitfully, and felt a little isolated, and the place scared me with its knowingness, its offhand vaunt, a style of mind and guise that can be harder to learn than some dialect of the Transvaal. Everybody knew the same seven things, but it could take you years to work through the list, and by that time the number would be different, or the whole list. They came out of the park on 90th Street, a band of hippies on a candlelight march, with flutes, drums, and tambourines, about 50 chanting people, and a man with a needle stuck in his protruding tongue, and a woman with a snake around her neck, and a haze of pungent smoke that had the whiff of some congenial misdemeanor. And there were kids walking along, and babies in backpacks and slings, and the marchers chanted a sort of hummed syllable, a thing with a twang. It sounded to me like bomb, a vibe with the gravid tone of prayer, repeated, repeated. But they wouldn't be chanting an ominous word, would they, with infants strapped to their chests and backs? And maybe Jerry had been correct. I didn't have the right to refuse him. This tremendous thing of his, this trip to the Bronx. I felt guilty about slipping away and betraying a sweet idea. I watched the marchers go south along the park edge. The streets began to darken, drained of traffic and headlights, and an odd calm set in, edged with apprehension. How many thousands, hundreds of thousands, trapped in subways, or aloft in packed elevators, waiting. The always seeping suspicion, paralysis, the thing implicit in the push-button city, that it will stop cold, leaving us helpless in the rat-eyed dark. And then we begin to wonder, as I did, how the whole thing works, anyway. I walked east on 96th Street, going empty and dead. Stores closed, bus stops deserted, phone booths unoccupied. Ego gone and vertigo, too. A city without its merengue spin. And a car pulled up at the center stripe, anonymous sedan going the other way. And the driver stuck his head into the gusty wind and called across to me. I said, "What? Where you go? I take you cheap." I looked at him. I was glad I'd walked away from Jerry. It would have been deadly. It would have been crap. I wouldn't have been able to listen to that crap. I got in the car and told the guy where my hotel was. I wanted to call Marion from my room if the phones were working. Marion Bowman, and tell her what was happening here, and ask what they knew about it there. There was a hole in the dashboard where the radio should have been located. But I asked the guy if he'd heard any news. "All out. State of Maine out. Boston, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, my sister lives. Ontario, Canada. Very big, this thing." I sat back and watched the streets roll by and saw what I could see in the moonlight. We'd be married 3 years later. Our daughter would be born in 1970. The year a small group of radicals bombed the Army Math Research Center at the University of Wisconsin in Marion's Big Ten town by igniting a carload of agricultural fertilizer and fuel oil. Killed one man, injured five others. We'd have a son 2 years later. Children. This was remote to me, sitting in the Romanians' car, or the Greeks'. Marriage remote. Fatherhood a vague regret somewhere in the kitchen smell of another country. The decade's not exactly unpromising, but remote. And maybe unpromising, too, in this phantom Manhattan, with only a few stragglers astir and the darkness so dense it had physical mass. I looked out the Greek's dusty window and could see the past, and never stopped seeing it, but could not summon the future, even in cartoon strokes, the strong, bright Sunday of the world. We rode without talking the rest of the way. And the enormity of the night. You could feel the night expanding, standing on the sidewalk near Times Square, a siren sounding half a mile away. I looked at the candles lined up on the desk in the lobby. The lobby was empty, and the candles threw light high on the walls. The clerk came out of a room somewhere.
I could take you up, but frankly, not necessary. I took up people, I lost count. I'll just take a candle.
The clerk held a flashlight. He gestured when he spoke, and the beam swung across the small lobby.
I did something to my back with the climbing, he said. But I lit these candles you can take in case some people come in, they don't have a match.
I took a candle and climbed the stairs to the fifth floor. When I entered the room, I went right to the window to see how the night looked from up here. I didn't call Marion. I felt a loneliness, for lack of a better word. But that's the word, in fact. A thing I tried never to admit to and knew how to step outside of. But sometimes even this was not means enough. And I didn't call her because I would not give in, watching the night come down.
This ends Disc 21.